Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am your host, Jay Ray. Yes, on Jay Ray Radio, but also on Carson's Corner. Yes, I am now officially a part of Carson's Corner, as I have always been. My shows will be played on Carson's Corner, and it is a huge, huge honor to be a part of this epic extravaganza. I would like to personally thank Bob Carson for this honor and this privilege. Before I get to tonight's show, I just want to say that I am proud to be affiliated with Carson's Corner, and as you guys know, we are no longer affiliated or promote Underground Progressive Radio 5:30 a.m. So, as you heard in the public service announcement last week. So, but without further ado, let's get to business here. I had the pleasure of interviewing this evening the director of photography of my favorite film, Bloodsport, and also the director of Kickboxer, Mr. David Wirth. And before I get to the show, I just want to say that Mr. David Wirth is a stand-up guy and very generous. I contacted him, I'd like to say, probably last month, and we've been coordinating this interview for quite some time, and, you know, and it's my pleasure and honor to bring it to you. You on Carson's Corner tonight. So without further ado, let me play that interview. I hope you guys enjoy this as much as I have, you know, putting it out there and recording it for the world to hear.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is David Wirth. I was the director of photography on Bloodsport and the director of Kickboxer, launching the career of Jean-Claude Van Damme. You're listening to Justin Ray Harvey.
Hi, this is Tony Luke Jr., a.k.a. Joey the Nail Nardone. And you're listening to Justin Ray Harvey.
This is Stan Bush. I sing Fight to Survive in the movie Bloodsport. You're listening to Justin Ray Harvey.
Hi, I'm Tony Luke Jr., also known as Joey the Nail. Please follow my friend, Justin Ray Harvey, on Facebook, Twitter, and Skype. His tag is at Justin Harvey. He's a great guy. I follow him, and I know you'll enjoy following him, too.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We are live on J Ray Radio. I am your host, Justin Ray Harvey. Sorry for the technical difficulties. I was having trouble dialing in to Blog Talk Radio for some reason. But without further ado, let's see if I can't get my guest on the line, Mr. David Wirth. He worked on the movie Bloodsport, and he was also the director of another great film called Kickboxer. So let me see if I can get him on the line.
I can hear you, Justin.
David, how's it going, my friend?
I'm here, dude. I'm here waiting.
Oh, awesome. How are you feeling tonight?
Excellent.
Awesome. So, welcome to the show, and I appreciate you coming on to the show with your busy schedule and a short notice. And I know that me and you have been corresponding this interview for quite a few weeks now. So,
it's my pleasure,
really,
Justin. I enjoyed hearing all of the voices and music and sounds from Bloodsport. It brought back a lot of good memories.
Awesome, awesome. So, to start things off, David, if you don't mind, could you tell my audience how you got involved with Bloodsport and also Kickboxer?
Certainly. I was actually doing a very big second unit at Warner Brothers on a film called Innerspace. It starred Martin Short. It was a big special effects movie, and I was DPing the second unit on it in Hollywood and also up in San Francisco. When I got an interview to go to Canon Pictures and interview for a little martial arts film called Bloodsport, and I went and met the producer, and I met the director, and we talked and chatted, and it was launching some new guy that I didn't know about called Jean-Claude Van Damme. And a few weeks after I had met the director, Newt Arnold, Newt had been an assistant director for Sam Peckinpah and William Friedkin. So he had really impeccable credentials, and that was the reason I wanted to do the movie, was just to work with Newt, because he had worked with a couple of my big heroes, Peckinpah, who did The Wild Bunch and Straw Dogs, and Bill Friedkin, who had done The French Connection and lots of great films. So I really wanted to work with Newt. He was directing, and a few weeks later I got the word that that I'd gotten the job, and I was going to be going to Hong Kong, which I had never done before. I hadn't been to Hong Kong. And I actually had to leave Innerspace a couple of weeks early. Most of the second unit had been done, and I went to the director, Joe Dante, and told him my situation. And he said, fine, we don't want to keep you from having this opportunity to go to DP a feature in Hong Kong. All the best. And he gave me a very nice send-off in front of the cast and crew, and I was off to Hong Kong.
Wow. Yeah, I actually wanted to tell you something too, now that I think about it. When I first met my instructor and one of my best friends in the world, Frank Dukes, when I interviewed him, the way he described you, he said that you were a brilliant mind to work with.
Well, that's very kind of Frank. Frank was great. You know, I mean, the movie, of course, was based on Frank. We took a lot of flights of fancy, but it was based on Frank. Frank was the original MMA underground fighter back in the day when those fights were illegal and done done off the grid and off the charts. And he was a very tough, bad dude to go and do that back in the day, because there were no rules, there was no sanctions, there was no having it on television so people could see it and make it popular. He was a tough guy, and we enjoyed having him on the film. He was there as our authority to go to make sure that we got it right, even though we weren't trying to make a documentary on his life. It was a fantasy based on his life, but it was a Hollywood feature with action and adventure and all of those good things. But Frank was a joy to work with. And if it wasn't for Frank, there wouldn't be a Bloodsport.
Oh, absolutely, and that has been my favorite film since I was 3 years old. So, I mean, that film and Frank's life has made a huge impact on me, and that's why it's such a huge honor to, you know, have you on my show tonight. And also, one of my other favorite films was Kickboxer. How did that come about, and did the direction go the way that you wanted it to go, or?
Very, very much so. One other comment on Bloodsport, there isn't a week goes by that someone doesn't tell me when they find out that I was the DP on Bloodsport, or they say that was my favorite film. I just finished teaching a couple of weeks of summer film camp at UCLA, and one of the mentors there came and he knew my work, and he said, did I ever tell you that Bloodsport was my favorite film when I was growing up? So it's a favorite with many people everywhere I go in the world. When they find out I did Bloodsport and Kickboxer, I hear that from young people, that they grew up with it, they saw it with their dad, it helped them go into filmmaking or martial arts or whatever. Kickboxer came about because the producer was the same producer who did Bloodsport, and he saw how well I got along with the Hong Kong crew when we did Bloodsport, and how I moved it along and got everything done efficiently. And I kept asking him, I kept saying, you know, I want to direct the next one. I didn't even know there was going to be a next one. No, you never know. We didn't know if the film was going to be a hit or a miss. Well, luckily, Mr. Van Damme, who I always like to say is the man who brought the art to martial arts, since he comes from a dancing background, he made it very artistic and poetic, as well as vicious and tough. And because of his good looks and his charm and his French accent, he also brought another element to martial arts that had never been there before in the audience. He brought ladies.
Mm-hmm.
He brought the ladies to the audience. So Kickboxer happened because Bloodsport was a hit. And actually, there was a period of time when we didn't know if we were going to get Mr. Van Damme back. He was off doing a couple of other things. He didn't know if he wanted to come back and do another one. And we actually did some casting and had another person in line to for that role. But when Jean-Claude came back, we were more than thrilled to have Jean-Claude back, because we all thought that he was really the reason why the film was a hit. So I worked very, very carefully. The film didn't come together very easily. The financing was there, and then it was gone, and then it came back again. And all during that time, I was polishing the script. I was doing my storyboards. I was working on the ad campaign and the poster. And 6 or 7 months went by that I worked on the film without really having a contract, without being paid for it. I rolled up my sleeves to show the producer how much I really wanted to do the project. And then eventually it all came together, and there was a big two-page ad, a centerpiece ad in the middle of Variety, saying that Kings Road was announcing that Bloodsport would be shot in Hong Kong, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme and directed by David Wirth. And we were off to Hong Kong for my second time in 2 years. Bloodsport was 1986, and Kickboxer was 1988. Incidentally, there was just a very, very famous anniversary that just happened to me a couple of days ago. I looked at my watch, and I saw that it was August 8th. That is 8-8. And 24 years ago, when we were in Hong Kong doing Kickboxer, the final script, the date that the final script had on it was 8-8-88, which is a very lucky number. 8 is a very lucky number for Chinese. And so everyone said, oh, this is going to be a very lucky production. And it was, because it was even bigger than Bloodsport. It went off and made Mr. Van Damme a big international star. And he was off and running, on what became a very, very long career. And like everyone else in our business, show business is full of hills and valleys, peaks and valleys. You have ups and downs. We all have, and Mr. Van Damme has. But I was so thrilled to see him back in a big movie with Stallone as the bad guy in Expendables last year.
Yeah, that was a great film. I actually went to see that on my birthday, and that was just, it was an awesome film to see all those, you know, all those stars work together and work
yes,
together so
beautifully. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Yeah.
So now that we've talked about kickboxer and Bloodsport, 25 years later, because here recently Bloodsport had the 25th anniversary, what are you doing now, David?
Well, I've been teaching for the last 7 years. I started teaching at the college level, teaching filmmaking to undergraduate and graduates. I started at Chapman University in Orange County. I also taught at USC for a semester. I taught at UCLA. I even went to Singapore and taught for a year at Chapman's new facility there, and lectured at the NYU Tisch Asia campus. And presently, I'm on the part-time faculty at UCLA, where I teach summer school, and at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco, where I teach cinematography and directing. So I have several film projects in various stages of production, but when you get to a certain age in the film business, the phone stops ringing. And the phone stopped ringing exactly at the time that I put my foot into academia and started teaching. So I've had a great time passing the knowledge that I learned in filmmaking for 35 years onto the young filmmakers of the next generation.
Wow. And, have you heard, there's actually a rumor on the internet that there's going to be a remake of Kickboxer in 2014.
Yeah, no, actually, they're remaking. I've heard that they're remaking both films, both of Bloodsport and Kickboxer. People have emailed me and sent me, information. Did you know about this? Did you know about that? And they're not remaking them in the sense of the same story. And I don't think they're doing. If they do remake Bloodsport, I don't think they're doing it as a Frank Duke story or Kickboxer in the same way. I think that they're reimagining those films and making them more high tech and high action and CGI effect to compete with today's marketplace. I think they're just taking the titles and going in a whole different direction. I don't know for sure. No one's shown me a script, but I'm theorizing that they're not remaking them in the same way we made the originals.
Mm-hmm. And also, I wanted to comment on Kickboxer. I was looking on YouTube and discovered that in some countries there is a deleted scene where Van Damme visits his brother in the hospital, and it didn't make the U.S. version. And I wondered if you knew about that and why that scene never made Kickboxer for the U.S. version.
I remember shooting the scene. I know the scene very well, and it was an emotional scene. I have a feeling for the U.S. version, the film was a little long, and so they cut it to be under 90 or 100 minutes, whatever the requirements for the distributor were. And for other parts of the world, they felt they could make it a little longer, and the scene got put back in.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was just curious about that because that is a wonderful scene, and it's very emotional. So
right.
So
well, John Claude is a fine actor, even in Bloodsport. He showed his acting chops. And he would always say, remember, I'm an actor first and then a martial artist. So he was more interested in portraying the emotion as much as he was interested in showing off his splits and his jumps and his leaps and his kicks.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, did you shoot anything for Bloodsport that you wanted to be in the film, but it ended up not being in the film?
No. Bloodsport, in fact, well, Newt Arnold directed Bloodsport, so I was the director of photography, and we shot a lot. Newt shot a lot of film on that. He shot like 240,000 feet of film, and all those fight scenes were covered very, very heavily. We had three Panavision cameras, and we would shoot each fight scene with three cameras wide. Then we would move the cameras in, tighten up the lenses, and move the cameras in. One camera was always on a dolly. We'd shoot the fight again, tighter. Then we would get on the mat and do handheld of the fight, and then we'd shoot the highlights of the fight, a certain punch or a kick or the last kick or the knockout in slow motion at 48 frames or 96 frames a second. So we really covered, we shot a lot of footage. And to my taste, we shot a little too much footage. And as a result, when I came back and directed Kickboxer, I was able to, instead of shooting 240,000 feet of film, I shot about 120,000 feet of film. And we shot for 42 days on Bloodsport. On Kickboxer, we shot for like 35 or 36 days. Even though we shot in two countries on Kickboxer, we shot in Hong Kong and Bangkok, and we made several trips back and forth. But in Kickboxer, it was all shot in Hong Kong. So I thought I was able to streamline the production, and make it a more efficient production, and I think I was able to pull that off.
Well, in my mind, David, you did a brilliant job with both films.
Thank you, Justin.
Because, you know, everybody that's been a martial artist, I know that they've seen Bloodsport or Kickboxer or even both. I mean, you know, they're cold, hard classics. So.
Yes, and I know that not a week goes by that they're not. I don't go tuning through cable and see one of them on a cable channel. They used to run Bloodsport every week on G4. I would go tune by and there it would be. And I know they're extremely popular. A lot of kids like yourself and others grew up with them, and they were classics. You know, they as I like to say, they launched Jean-Claude's career. He went on to do a lot more. Films, a lot bigger films, but those two, Bloodsport and Kickboxer, were very special. They were small films. Both of those films together didn't cost $5 million. Bloodsport was $2.2 million. Kickboxer was like $2.3 or $2.4 or $5 million. So both of those films combined were made for under $5 million, and yet they did astounding grosses worldwide and launched Mr. Van Damme into the stratosphere. So they were small films. In fact, when I was directing Kickboxer, I was at Canon Pictures, and they were the distributors of Bloodsport, and I was walking around, and I happened to find a folder that showed all of their profits and losses, and they had all these big $35 million films, Journey to the Center of the Earth, and this big film and that big film, all $35, $40 million films. None of them made a profit. All the way down to the bottom of the page, the only film that was showing a profit was the little $2.2 million Bloodsport. I thought that was pretty good.
That is fantastic, and a lot of people don't know this, but there's on the music side of things, there's two soundtracks to Bloodsport. One was only available to purchase from Germany, and then the other was released U.S. in 2007. And then there's two different soundtracks for Kickboxer. Two different releases.
I did not know that. I'm only familiar with the original Hollywood release of both films, the music and the soundtrack from both films. I wasn't aware of a German release or any other release or any different release. Did they change the music?
I think so. What I can do, David, when we get done with the show, I can send you links and information about it, because
Fine.
I said, I'm a big fan of Bloodsport, and that's pretty much what I do. I mean, I've got Bloodsport pretty much everything. So
that's cool. It's a good little movie, and it certainly was a stepping stone in my career and Mr. Van Damme's career. And you know that there's one great actor who was in that film who just had a very small bit part in that, who went on to win an Academy Award. Who's that?
Wasn't that Forrest Whitaker?
Forrest Whitaker. Yes, Forrest Whitaker is a great African-American actor. He's won the Academy Award, does his own films. And if you listen carefully, you can hear his voice on the NFL channel. He's the voice of football. He's just a wonderful actor. And we were very privileged to have him in a small part in that film. And he went on to do Color of Money and lots of other huge films where he stole scenes from Paul Newman. And just an astounding actor. So that was thrilling.
Oh, absolutely, and I wanted to ask you, how did you guys, like, you know the video game scene where Frank Dukes is playing Ray Jackson and they first meet?
Right.
How did you shoot the video game scene?
Do you have a phone ringing? Is that you?
Yeah, but I'm in the middle of this, so...
We shot the scenes with Don Gibb and Jean-Claude separately from the video game, and we had to do the video game as an insert because the video games were very, very primitive back in those days, and we had to have somebody operating the video game to make it do what we wanted it to do, and we were filming that with our 35mm cameras, and we cut everything together in the editing.
I see.
The guys were really playing that game. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, after seeing that scene, I had to get that game. I was like, I have to get that now. You know, so
cool.
I mean,
that's
a classic scene. And speaking of Forrest Whitaker, what was funny about the film is like he didn't have very many lines, and when he did speak, He got interrupted all the time.
Yeah, that was the joke between the other actor and Forrest. Their parts were smaller, and they were like they were instrumental in telling the story of the film. So in order to make those parts interesting, they came up with the idea of every time Forrest would try to say something, he would say too much, and the other guy would interrupt him. So they actually brought more reality and more interest to the characters by their improvising and adding the character of Forrest trying to speak and always being interrupted by his older partner.
Yeah, I always thought that was amusing.
Yes, and that's the reason why they did it, because they realized they were small parts and they wanted to bring another dimension to them, and they did a fine job.
Mhm. And I'd like to comment, David, if they did make a remake of Bloodsport, which I know they're talking about doing it, I would love to see you work on the film.
Well, I would love to work on any film. I'm the kind of guy that I do any film that comes across my desk. One of my heroes in the film business, two of my heroes in the film business were D.W. Griffith and John Ford. And when I started looking into their lives, I realized that back in the early 1900s, D.W. Griffith invented the language of movies while he was working at a studio called Biograph, because over a five-year period, he made not 100, not 200, not 300, not 400. He made over 450 one- and two-reel movies while he and his cinematographer, Billy Bitzer, invented the language of filmmaking that we use today. And
wow.
And John Ford did the same thing. 20 years later, he made like 30 or 40 10-day westerns before he ever did one of his serious feature films. Those guys were my heroes, and I knew I would never get a chance to do 60 or 100 or 200 or plus movies in my life. So I just took anything I could get my hand, any film that came across my desk, I didn't care if it was action, if it was horror, if it was a love story, if it was a TV series, if it was a first unit, if it was a second unit, if it was martial arts, if it was a thriller. I didn't care. I just wanted to get the work because I wanted to get my chops. I wanted to learn as much about filmmaking as I could, and the only way to learn is to do it. Just like playing an instrument. The only way you get your chops
absolutely.
Is by playing
it's
an
like,
instrument.
It's like you wanted to do anything that you could, you know? I mean, any type of film. I mean,
absolutely.
That shows your passion for, you know, for filming is you don't limit yourself just one type of film. You're like, I'll take anything that I can get, you know, and that's the way to be.
Yeah, that was my philosophy.
Mhm. So I mean, but like I said, David, it's a huge honor to speak with you. I mean, you know, I never would have dreamed that I would be speaking with you. So.
Well, I think you contacted me via email. I think you found my email address and contacted me. I'm happy to talk to anyone at any time. I'm very easy to find. I'm on IMDb under David Worth Kickboxer. I can be reached via email at davidworthfilm@gmail.com. I'm happy to talk to anyone at any time about either my career or any film questions that they might have. That's what I do now. I write books and I teach. I've got a book. The first book that I had published in 2008 was called The Citizen Kane Crash Course in Cinematography, and it's mm-hmm. available at Amazon.com. And it's a fun book that... that is an introduction to filmmaking for young people. I tried to make it a page turner for young people who might be interested in learning about the film business and cinematography.
Oh, absolutely. And unfortunately, we're getting close to out of time, David. And I just wanted to tell my listeners that you can also find David on Facebook as well. So.
I'm there. I don't check it out very often because I'm not a Facebook fan. I don't want to. I think there's a lot of narcissism and navel gazing there. It's kind of a waste of time for me. But I'm there and I check in to see my grandchildren and a few other things. But I'm not one of these people that makes a post every time I go buy a pair of shoes or change my picture.
Oh, absolutely, David. And I just wanted to say real quickly before I let you go, thank you again. And next time I have you on the show, maybe we can promote your book or anything new that you got going on, we can always promote. And I'm sure me and you will be emailing back and forth, of course. I'm very grateful.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jess. I'm happy to do it anytime. I also was the director of photography on two films for Clint Eastwood, Bronco-Billy and Any Which Way You Can, and there's a whole story there. So I've done over 35 movies, and each one of them, not a lot of them were award-winning films, but they were my kids. I loved them. I was passionate about them, and I'm happy to chat with you about them anytime.
Oh, that would be great, and like I said, I will be sending, you know, just out of fun, I'll be sending you those that information on those two Bloodsport soundtracks.
Terrific.
And just you know, some interesting facts that I've, you know, found through the years, and like I said, David, I appreciate everything that you've done, and you know, I'm hoping eventually that I'll get the opportunity to, you know, sit down with you and meet you face to face. That would be awesome.
Well, hopefully it'll happen. Thank you, Justin. I enjoyed chatting with you, and as I said, I'm happy to do it anytime.
Thank you, David. And do you have any final thought for my listeners before I let you go?
Well, all of the young filmmakers out there, I think that what they should be doing is It's like what Kurt Cobain did in the 1990s when he was forming garage bands, because the technology was there to make records in your garage that would go out and reach the public. Now you can form garage filmmakers. You can be garage filmmakers because the technology is there with DSLRs, with nonlinear editing. Once you have a DSLR high def camera and a nonlinear editing system, you're your own studio, and you can greenlight your own productions, get your friends together, and make a movie, and I highly encourage it. I have lots of stories I can tell about independent filmmaking, but that's another show.
Oh, absolutely, because like I said, David, you are welcome on my show anytime you want, my friend. So.
Okay, Justin, all the best.
All the best to you, David. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
And ladies and gentlemen, that was David Worth. I had a blast doing this interview, and judging by this interview, I will definitely have David Worth back on my show at some point in the year, so stay tuned for that, and stay tuned for the next edition of J. Ray Radio. Take care, everybody, and remember, show some respect.
And I am back live on J. Ray Radio. I really enjoyed doing the interview. I hope you enjoyed listening. I may be with you a few minutes longer, but first I'm going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll get back to the show. So hang tight with me, people.
Get over here!
Hi there, this is Justin Ray Harvey of J. Ray Radio and the co-host of Carson's Corner with Bob Carson. we have an announcement. We are no longer affiliated with Underground Progressive Radio 5:30 a.m. Even though we've had a critical change in the programming, our programming will remain the same. Times are subject to change, so just sit back and enjoy the program as you normally would. The only change is we've grown bigger and better, and like I said, we no longer support or advertise Underground Progressive Radio 5:30 a.m. in any way. Thank you and show some respect. And we are live on J-Ray Radio on Carson's Corner. I have a special caller that is no stranger to Carson's Corner. Let's bring him on the air. He is the proud creator and owner of Carson's Corner, Bob Carson himself. So let's get him on the air. Hey, Bob.
Hey, this is Joe Lewicki of Memphis, Tennessee. And I got to tell you, you know, I am sick and tired of you progressives out there that just want to argue with emotion. You want to argue using your heart, and you don't want to use the facts. And I don't know what is wrong with you, but you and that co-host that you normally have are horrendous, okay? You guys need to be taken off the air because the amount of misinformation that you pump out there is absolutely disgusting, okay? That's what I thought.
I got a question for you. Are you a right winger or something?
You son of a bitch! I'm gonna tell you what, my friend. I'm gonna come down there to West Virginia, and I'm gonna go to whatever fucking ramshackle Bob Carson lives in, and I'm just gonna beat the crap out of both of you. Okay? You understand that? Do you know what I'm capable of, God damn it?
Bring it on.
Oh, man. Well, listen, Justin, it's absolutely great to call. I'm glad that you're doing the show tonight. I didn't have an opportunity to listen to, I guess you've been on the air for almost an hour now. I just got out of work, which is really, really flattering to me because my working conditions are abysmal. And I don't want to mention the company I work for, but they're a pretty disgusting company. I'm anxious to hear, you know, the first 45 minutes of the show, but I wanted to call in and just, you know, touch base with you and sort of shoot the breeze here.
Oh, absolutely. Bob, and I got to tell you, this company that you speak of, you know that I hate the fucking company to no end because I was done wrong by this fucking company too. So me and you share the same pain.
Exactly. I mean, they are they're horrendous. They're harmful to the community. And management, the management that works there is, in my opinion, equally culpable because in order to be a manager in this place, you have to toe the company line. You know, no person is going to work for a business or a corporation like this without essentially being indoctrinated. It's almost like a cult mentality where if you have any type of independent thought or any amount of ethics or whatnot, you're not going to fit into this company because companies are kingdoms. They are not democracies. Mm-hmm. You know, the responsibility that I have to my employer never ends. I'm forced to the work of three or four people. I have to work in dangerous conditions. And the only responsibility that my company has is to pay me a wage. And so, you know, the balance of our labor system in America is flawed, where, you know, companies have basically ownership over you, your property, your commodity. And so, you know, I feel bad. I really do, like, feel bad for anybody that wants to make a career in this company because what that says to me is I have no problem with people making careers in companies. I mean, you know, if a company pays you well, and they're a decent outfit, there's room to grow in their ethical operation, and they produce some sort of value for society, then that's great. But this particular company, it's the worst out there. And I really, I almost look down on people that want to try to have a career at this company, because it says to me that they're selling out, like they have nothing left inside. They have to sell their soul to this piece of crap, you know, corporation, which is destroying our society, Justin.
Yeah, and this same company, Bob, the only reason that they hire people like me with somebody that's disabled is so that they can get a kickback.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I know that firsthand. I know that for a fact, and it's unfortunate, too. And they're doing the same thing with veterans, too. Now they're having this big phony push about, you know, hiring veterans and all this stuff, and it's all meaningless. It's all for show. It's all a PR stunt for, you know, a company that, you know, I mean, once my employment situation changes, I can really go in depth about, you know, some of the practices, because I think that some of the practices need to be exposed. I think people really need to be educated about, you know, what is going on, because it ultimately affects all of us. You know, an injury to one is an injury to all. And,
absolutely,
you know, we need to fight back, because I'm telling you, companies like this are taking over. They have more economic power than most developed countries in the world, and that becomes a problem. And we're becoming a nation of wage slaves, where you have to submit to employment because you need employment to survive, and the very owners and the very corporations, the very kingdoms that I speak of, they control the employment. And so, therefore, you basically, we're not a free country. You know, we keep on hearing freedom and liberty, this and that. No, we're not a free country by any means, and it's only getting worse. And what it's going to take is people like me and people like Justin to continue to do this radio show and offer independent radio out there to make people aware. You know, I'm proud to say there are thousands of people that listen to our show each week. It's very, very important, and we're going to continue to, you know, carry on to try to cause some sort of change.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. And speaking of radio show, just so that your listeners doesn't think that I, you know, hijacked your page or anything. Anytime that Bob is absent, folks, and he needs me to cover anything on any topic on Carson's Corner, I will be filling in for Bob.
Yes, that's going to happen more often. I think that's a great idea. And, you know, Justin, we've talked about this in the past, where I have no problem if you want to move your show onto the channel. I think it'd be great. I think it'll give you more flexibility. You know, when you have these interviews unexpectedly, and they exceed, you know, a half hour, you have to put it out there. So I really have no problem with that. I think it'll be great. I think it'll be great for the listeners out there. And like I've said, you know, that channel is your channel as well.
Absolutely. And vice versa, because we're also just debating on whether to do a wrestling type topic or segment of the show. So that's still in talks, ladies and gentlemen. But that's something that me and Bob is seriously considering.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun. I got to tell you, I'm starting to become more interested in covering the so-called fake pro wrestling than I am MMA. But it just so happens in the MMA world, my show is popular, and the interviews that we do are the best in the business. So it's not like I can't really walk away from the MMA industry, even though I really get disgusted by it, and I think that there is some evidence that it's peaking in the United States, And it's just becoming a big spectacle now. It really is. I mean, you know, with Ronda and the women's division and, you know, everything, how these cards are built, how they're promoted, it doesn't seem like a sport anymore. And, you know, this is something that I've been saying for a long time.
Exactly, Bob. And I'm going to make a point here, and I'm not going to mention any names because you know who I'm talking about, but, I mean, you have interviewed popular fighters, you know, that have entered in the MMA big time, and then I'll go to write them or something, and then they're too good to come on J Ray Radio or Carson's Corner. That's what disgusts me.
That's, you know, that's a great point because that's what feeds into my frustration too. I'll throw out a name because he's very popular, and I really don't care. I had on Benson Henderson a couple of years ago. Very nice guy. He was on my show for maybe about 40 minutes or so, and you know he swore he would come back to the show. And if I text Benson now, I still have his number. If I text him, I can't even get a response. I'll throw out another name, Shane Carwin, who recently retired. He really was a, in my opinion, a subpar MMA fighter. Just, you know, an arrogant guy, in my opinion, who I know people that were close to Shane that wouldn't even take their phone calls after he got some level of fame. In fact, he actually screened the people that would contact him. And I'm talking about people that knew him for a long time. And, you know, I interviewed Shane Carwin in 2008, right before he fought Christian Welish in his first UFC fight. And I told him, I said, you know, hey, listen, when you become the heavyweight champion, will you come back on Carson? Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. And they never do because now it's there's no loyalty. It's all about going on, oh, ESPN or SureDog or you know, now you got MMA that's on television, Spike TV. You know, HDNet, all these different television stations and networks are now showing MMA. And guys like myself, you know, I've been reporting on this since 2006, man. I mean, you could go back. There weren't a lot of people doing MMA radio when I started. It was Eddie Goldman. It was Ryan Bennett of MMA Weekly who passed away. And I think there was one show called Icon Radio or something like that out of Hawaii. That was it. After I started, that's when you started to see SureDog pop up, all these different, now every website has a podcast now. And that's partially because of what I was able to do in the industry. I was able to get a lot of attention, get a lot of fighter interviews on virtually, you know, a nothing budget. And it's unfortunate because it's become a very, very selfish industry. Look at someone like Tito Ortiz, who's fighting in Bellator now, I believe November 2nd, fighting Rampage Jackson. Let me tell you something. You know, Tito's been around the sport a long time, and he listens to my show, or he has in the past, and he emailed me one time, you know, complimenting the show, wanting to come on the show, and then I tried to set up an interview with him, and he wanted to charge me money to have him come on my show. That's the type of attitude that some of these people have in our sport, and I got to tell you, it just makes me disgusted. It makes me not even want to have to deal with it. The reason why I continue to do the show is because the show is primarily an interview-driven show, you know, where I have a great knack when it comes to interviewing. We have a great producer who can really, really ask the questions that nobody asks. He really knows the inside stories. And that's why a lot of people listen to the program. But, you know, if it wasn't for that, sometimes like I don't even feel like covering it, Justin.
Yeah, I mean, Bob, let's face it. I mean, how ridiculous is that for someone to say, well, you got to pay me, to fucking promote me? How ridiculous is that?
It is. You know, Tito has a reputation for that. I've heard that Tito charges people for autographs. I don't want to say that everybody in the industry is bad. There are some good guys. You know, there's a guy, I know Frank doesn't like him, but John McCarthy, the referee, longtime referee, police officer. You know, his wife got into the promoting business. John McCarthy is a pretty famous guy. He's been since the beginning. He loves MMA. He's a smart guy. He knows all about the rules, and he holds seminars really all over the place, educating people, trying to train judges and everything. John McCarthy does his part to make MMA better, and I could probably text John McCarthy now or whenever, and he'll appear on the show. He doesn't care. You know, some of the older guys, even a guy like John Peretti, John Peretti is probably one of the most awkward interviews I can have, because he's kind of like a brash guy. He's kind of like a no-holds-barred guy, like really like just like very, very nice guy, but kind of like a little intimidating. He's the former UFC matchmaker and promoter and martial artist as well, commentator. He commentated in the YAMA 2008 when Meyerowitz asked him to. He'll come on the show. You know, I think he's got a book coming out too. So there are good people in the sport, mainly the older people, but some of these people you see on television now, on the cover of magazines now, they completely forget about, you know, what helped them to achieve that success.
Exactly. It's like, you know, here's how it should be. Instead of us paying them, they should, even though we don't ask for it, Bob, I want to go on the record.
Yeah.
They should pay us to promote them. Because that's what we're doing. So.
That's right. And some of these people, you know, it's therapeutic for them, because they can come on the show and not be asked the stupid questions like you hear on other shows, like, oh, did you hook up with this person? Did you get drunk before you, you know, these real sophomore questions that you hear. We ask, you know, really, really tough questions and real probing questions, in my opinion. And it's good for fighters to really broadcast that. I mean, you know, I'm at the point where I don't care. I'm an independent guy. I'm not looking to, you know, get on any type of website or, you know, make any money off of this. I'm doing it because I think it's necessary in some respect. I think there's a major problem in MMA when it comes to fighters' pay, and nobody wants to talk about how little these fighters are being paid. And Zuffa, the parent company of the UFC, has a real huge machine when it comes to intimidating fighters and press people asking certain questions. I mean, there's no question that there's a certain culture within Zuffa, and you're not hearing a lot of independent voice. It goes back to what I was saying with the corporation that I work for, where in order to so-called get capital behind you, in order to get access to, you know, some of these guys, like I'm talking to Benson Henderson, this guy, that guy, you have to essentially sell yourself out on some level. You have to be basically a crony. And that's the God's honest truth. It really is. And it's unfortunate. It really is. People that are watching this are not getting the information that they need. The MMA fans are by and large, uneducated about the sport. I can guarantee you that most of the people watching the UFC or watching Bellator have no idea about the history of the UFC, have no idea, you know, about how the Fertitta brothers purchased the UFC and all these other important issues. It just gets whitewashed because right now we live in a culture where everything depreciates within 10 seconds. You know, I mean, if you're a UFC fighter and you lose once or twice, you're no longer viable. You know, even Ronda Rousey to her recently said that, you know, in another couple of years or so, I probably won't be fighting. And that's a very realistic approach, because that's the way it is, because it's that depreciation that favors the promoters.
Absolutely. And I just, you know, I wanted to make a comment, Bob, and get your feedback on it as well. I think that Gina Carano was a really good fighter, and then the reason she started losing is she got wrapped up in the Hollywood lifestyle and quit training.
Yeah, I agree. That's absolutely correct. And, you know, you're seeing that. We haven't seen that with Ronda, but, you know, Ronda's going to be in some movies now. She's going to be in The Expendables 3, and then there's some talk about her being in Fast and the Furious, and it only makes sense. I mean, it only makes sense that people that, you know, move to Hollywood or spend a lot of time doing a movie are going to have to give up training. So, you know, that's what you're seeing. I mean, even George St. Pierre, I think George St. Pierre is going to be in a movie coming up, and we're going to see what type of effect it has on his career. And, you know, I mean, in a way, it's good. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that if an MMA fighter can do a movie and make a lot of money, like Gina Carano with Haywire, and that was a pretty big film with Michael Douglas and everything, if she can do that, that's great, because that could better her life. It certainly will better her life financially and help her out. And it's great that Ronda is so popular. She's on the cover of Maxim. And it's great that she's doing movies, and she's probably making a lot of money. And, you know, it's a good thing that the UFC is so popular that a small percentage of fighters can actually go out and make movies and make money outside of the UFC, although I'm sure that the UFC has some sort of percentage that they get off of the money that Ronda gets from movies and so on and so forth, because they basically have it on lockdown. But the reality is that it's like capitalism. It's like where you have a small percentage of people that can make a lot of money and have a lot of opportunities for themselves, and the vast majority of people in MMA are, you know, living paycheck to paycheck. They're not making a lot of money, and that's what we need to change. I mean, you look at other sports. Look at someone that's, you know, rides the bench in an NBA team or a football team, and they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars each year. The same should be for every fighter in the UFC. I don't care. You know, let's get these guys paid.
As we were discussing, I think it was a few weeks ago, Bob, me and you we had a really good topic going. We was talking about films and movies and stuff and how they're freaking remaking everything. I think the reason that they're remaking everything is to make a quick buck. But not only that, they're running out of ideas to make films.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I mean, you know, I'm a big movie guy, and I go to the movies here in Freehold, and a lot of times they're sold out because they just redid the movie theater and they put these lounge seats in now. So, you know, I almost get into fights when I go along, because you get these kids that come in right before the movie starts, and you know they wander in, and you know they want to all sit together, and I'm just the odd man out and everything, and you know, there are some original movies out there, but yeah, I think it's the way our culture is. I mean, look at reality TV now. You know, I mean, everything is a spinoff of a spinoff. I stopped watching TV really going back to 2000, once you really started to see the rise of reality shows, because I just see it cheap. I just see it, you know, imitation-like, no originality. And I don't want to watch it. I really don't. You know, it goes back to, you know, I want to say conditioning. I think that the American public, to some extent, is conditioned to appreciate these films, the way they're marketed and everything like that. And, you know, the commercials that suggest that, oh, you don't watch this film, and, you know, you're going to be this or you're going to be that. It's the same thing. It's with consumerism, where, you know, oh, if you don't have the latest iPad or this and that, then you're you know, out. You're not cool. The girls aren't going to sleep with you and that. And a lot of people buy it. I think a lot of people buy these remakes, and there's no originality. There's nothing to them. And it's, I don't know, it just makes for, I mean, in terms of the landscape, the entertainment, it just makes for fewer choices that we have.
Absolutely, and I'll give you a good example, Bob. The Karate Kid, a classic film, and I don't care what anybody says, I think they butchered it. I think they screwed it up. I think it makes no sense, and I don't like it.
Well, yeah, I didn't see that film, but that was with Will Smith, and and his son, right? And that was Jada Smith in that film.
Yep.
It was just.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It was horrible. You know about?
Who was in that film, though?
Jaden Smith and Jackie Chan.
Okay. The Will Smith's wife wasn't in that film, was she?
She might have been, Bob. I'm not sure. So.
Yeah, I didn't see it. You know, I don't know how it did. I mean, but I wouldn't see it. I would have no, because they're going to change it around. And I mean, the Karate Kid, the first Karate Kid, was a great film. It's too bad. I don't believe it's on Netflix. I may try to search it tonight, but it was a great film because you had a lot of different, I want to say, issues playing out there. You had Daniel LaRusso, who moved to California from New York, and he was a poor kid. From, you know, his mother was a waitress, and she was struggling. They lived in this rundown apartment complex where Mr. Miyagi was fixing everything, and there was the rich, the Cobra Kai, you know, Johnny Lawrence, who, you know, presumably was a rich kid, and he was dating this other rich girl, a rich kid in Allie, and Allie's parents sort of looked down on Daniel. Oh, not that boy from Reseda.
Yeah.
And it was funny. It was just, you know, kind of a, you know, class issues going on there. And then you had Martin Krause, I want to say his name, is the Sensei John Kreese, or Martin Cove, I think that's his name. And he was this real aggressive guy in the Cobra Kai. They were, you know, they didn't fight to defend. They fought to attack. They learned, you know, martial arts to attack people. It was actually kind of comical, but it was good. I mean, it was a good film. It was good acting and everything like that. It was an original plot. And, you know, they made four or five of them. You know, I liked the, you know, Karate Kid 4 with Michael Ironside, with Hilary Swank. That was a good film. But, you know, lot of times they can't duplicate the success of earlier films. And speaking of films that are coming out, you know there's a new Rocky movie coming out?
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a spinoff type deal. It's supposed to be that years later, Apollo Creed's grandson wants to be a fighter, even though he has Apollo's money and all this stuff. He wants to be a fighter, so he ends up tracking down Rocky or something, and they end up training together or something.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, you know, they Sylvester Stallone is still making a lot of movies. That's for sure. He's got to be pushing 70 years old, the guy.
You know, just when I thought that they were going to leave the Rocky, you know, franchise alone, here they are doing something.
Yeah.
But as I say again, I think it's just to make another buck.
Well, you know, to his credit, the Expendables did very well, the last Expendables, and I saw that too, with all the superstars in that film, Randy Couture, you know, Jet Li, and so on. And so, I mean, there are people going out to see these films. It's I don't know what the last Rocky did. I don't think the last Rocky did as well as the last Expendables. And the last Rocky, that was, what, in 2008? Or something like that. I mean, you know, there comes a point where you just got to say enough is enough. But that's what you see. A lot of these guys are still trying to make films. And I ask myself, why does someone like Bruce Willis or Sylvester Stallone or remember Arnold Schwarzenegger did that film like a year or two ago where he was the sheriff? These guys are pushing 70 years old. Arnold Schwarzenegger was in the Expendables too. They're pushing 70 years old, these guys. It's like, you know, as a viewer, aren't at some point we're going to be insulted to see someone 70 years old beating up someone that's, you know, half their age and running through a jungle and this and that? I mean, I'm not disparaging action films. I love certain action films, and I love movies in general, but enough is enough. Like and going back to the first Karate Kid, I get offended when I come on like Will Smith's son. Like, Will Smith's son and Will Smith did that movie, I forget what it was called, but it was a real flop. You know, After Earth or After Something, I don't know, where it was some sort of space movie. And it was a real disaster. And I don't want to see these people. You know, I don't want to see Will Smith's son. I'm sure there's another talented actor out there that just doesn't have to have a famous father. You know, it's just that's another thing that the corporate media does is now the children of famous people get reality shows and get jobs and movie roles and this and that. It's just, you know, there's no originality anymore. The population, by and large, is dumb. We're dumbed down, okay? We're dumbed down for the purposes of, I would argue, consumerism, okay? And, you know, they want us to spend our money so that, I guess, the economy can go around and about. But the products that they're putting out there are not that good. And it's the same thing with the UFC. It's the same thing everywhere. Everywhere, you know? And so my only only solution is just to not buy that garbage. Just not, you know, that's why I don't own a television. That's why I don't watch these reality shows. That's why I don't, you know, buy these magazines and try to buy these clothes and this and that, because it means nothing to me. I want my value to be measured by the ideas that I have, you know, not necessarily by what I look like or where I live, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, Bob, but I got to say, if I had the opportunity, I would love to have a movie done about me and about my battles in life and how I ended up working with you and meeting Frank Dukes. And I think if it was put together right and done right, it could be a really good story.
I agree with that. I think that would produce a tremendous amount of value for people out there and for people to see your struggles and all of your ambitions and what you do, you know, how you volunteer to help people. Good.
So, I mean, I think it would be a good film. And like I've always suggested to you, Bob, and I'll say this on public record, I think you should write a book. I mean, just, even on just politics alone, I mean, you could write your own book. I really, Bob, I don't really understand why you've never even, you know, talked about maybe doing that.
Well, I mean, you know, you can. I know some people that may be able to get it published. You know, it's the thing about it is that there's no, like I was saying before, there's really no independent media out there. You know, years ago, you used to have union books. You used to have union publications, union publishers. You know, you'd have union newspapers, union radio stations and television stations and so on and so forth. And, you know, now, Noam Chomsky writes about this in his book, Understanding Power, or he's spoken about this, and he writes about this, how now, you know, everything is capital funded. You know, the capital has to go into pretty much everything. And, you know, there's not going to be someone that's going to put his money down behind something that is essentially going to question the very system that has made him rich. It's very, very difficult because that's the way it is. In order to get to the point where your book is going to be published and whatnot, I would argue that you really have to almost fit a certain role, just like anything. You know, if you want to move up in a company, you've got to fit a certain role. It's the same thing in publishing. You know, I mean, and granted, you could do it independently. I'm sure if you get enough of a following out there and there's enough of a demand, then a publisher may be willing to, you know, publish your book and may be able to you know, hook up with a company to advertise and so on. But it's very, very difficult. It really is. It's the way I look at it is the radio show is almost like my book and everything. You know, I mean, I know, like, you know, myself, and I'm sure I probably can speak for you on this. It's there's almost no time to do anything anymore. You know, between work and school.
Exactly. It's like I would love to finish my book, but I'm still not 100% satisfied with it. I mean, you know, I mean, and to sit there and write a book, it's easier said than done, people.
Yeah,
so.
It is. And a lot of times, you know, people, it's just like anything, you know, once they have a brand, a lot of times there's something called ghostwriters where you'll have someone like Sarah Palin or one of these right-wing figures out there, I can name some others too, that are supposedly authoring a book, but it's really not even written by them. It's a ghostwriter. And so, you know, people aren't even buying their ideas. And, you know, the publishing industry, I you know, there's stuff out there. I mean, you can go to blogs. You can go to certain websites and certain independent writers out there that don't have capital behind them and don't have to worry about advertisers and this and that. I mean, you know, could you imagine what would happen if they took our show, just hypothetically, if they took our show and they put it on ESPN Radio or one of these bigger radio stations, how would that fit in? Because first of all, you know, you'd have to sound a certain way, right? You hear these guys with their radio voices, sound like they have freaking marbles in their mouth half the time. You have to look a certain way, right? They have to put you on the website. They have to crop you up. They got to polish you up. And I'm too fat to be on any type of website. So, you know, like I wouldn't last on that end. And you have to say the right thing. You're basically property. You're basically owned. And that's one thing that I love about our show is that we're not owned. We're nobody's property. You know, I can look a certain way. I could say whatever the hell I want to. And I don't have to worry about advertisers who's getting pissed off. And I don't think we have that controversial with show. But the point is that it's independence. And that's not something that you can get pretty much anywhere out there. I mean, once you start to get advertisers and once you start to get, you know, bigger stations or publications, that's when the bias comes in. And it's just, it's unfortunate. It really is, because I always say don't watch the media. Don't trust anybody on the corporate media, because somebody that's, you know, talking to you on a television is being put there for a reason. And, you know, this is something interesting, is that Noam Chomsky talks about how if you talk to some of these useful idiots, you know, these TV pundits and reporters and everything, right, people that, again, are part of a certain mold and they you know, there's a big filtering process that has to be done in order to get these people to where they're at. Well, if you talk to one of these people, they will tell you that nobody tells me what to say. Nobody tells you what to write. Yeah, because the corporation that owns you already knows what you're going to say. They already know what you're going to write. And that's the bottom line. And that's good.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, Bob. We got about 11 minutes left of the show. And I wanted to get your thoughts on something that you've never, you know, told your listeners. But do you think, like with social media, we have a lot of good things as far as social media. We've got Twitter, we've got Facebook, we've got Google+, we've got YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, do you think that we're going overboard with having too many websites and this and that, and it's just becoming this big glob of something that it's just too much of it? What's your thoughts, Bob?
I agree. You know, if you look at kids nowadays, you look at how families interact, nobody interacts with each other anymore. You've got these damn smartphones, and I won't buy a smartphone. You know, I had a smartphone a few years ago, and it was a disaster. It was so expensive. Verizon Wireless siphoned me for $800. This cell phone broke down, the smartphone, and you know, I just said enough is enough. Let me get rid of it. But people are addicted to technology. People are addicted to these sites. And you know, technology is good in the sense that technology solves problems. Technology is brought to us in large part due to the United States government, and it solves problems. And social media sites can be good. It can give an opportunity to someone to express themselves, but we're becoming too addicted to it now. We're becoming too addicted to Twitter and Instagram and all these other different websites. And I think that you know part of the reason why is we become a very self-centered society. Okay, and myself included. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying I'm not part of the fray here, but we've become a very self-centered society where everything is about me, 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 me. And so, you know, if I could take a picture of myself and post it and get attention, that's great. I mean, you're seeing this now with even people like Geraldo Rivera, the Looney Tune, the clown on Fox News, who this guy's supposedly a serious journalist and radio host. He takes a picture posing without his shirt on. It really fits the self-centered culture that we have in America, and I do think it's getting too big. And you know, with these social networking sites, there could be a whole host of problems associated with them. And one of the things that we're seeing now, especially with Facebook, is the selling of information. You know, when I go on my Facebook and I go on pretty much wherever I surf the web, I'm seeing things about talk radio. I'm seeing things about colleges. I'm seeing things about this and that. And it just so happens that I'm interested in these things. So these websites are most likely selling our information to advertisers, okay, who, you know, are run by corporations. And they're learning everything about us. And now it's getting to the point now where I can't even go on Facebook or I can't even go on YouTube and not watch a commercial. I mean, everything, you know, it's like everywhere you go, there's just commercials. There's just advertisements. It's the corporations, you know, finding their way, penetrating, and finding their way to advertise their product to us, which I find annoying, because you know you expect to see advertisements on television. You know, if I want to watch a YouTube video, I got to sit through an advertisement now. And it's just, you know, I guess it's their right to do it, but to me, it's you know irritating, but. Yes, I think that we are too much. We're too film. Everybody has, too film doesn't make any sense, but everybody has a camcorder. Everybody has a video recorder, and it's so quick to, you know, upload it online. And I don't know. I mean, there's some positive aspects to it and some negative aspects to it as well. I mean, you know, Justin, you and I could be famous instantaneously. You know, if something happens on our show or something happens in our personal life, we could be famous. You and I have the opportunity, because of the Internet, to interview people and have a radio show and have thousands of people listening. And you know, we could advertise our show on social networking. So in that aspect, it's good. But there are some dark areas associated with online social networking. The people should check out Megan is Missing, which is a really, really disturbing film. If you go on Netflix, you could see about the dangers of, I mean, that deals with, you know, online chat and everything, but it goes along with a lot of the things we're talking about. You're posting pictures and trying to get attention and, you know.
Oh, exactly. And I'm going to say this, Bob, and I'm not going to mention any names, but I myself and you yourself ran into a mutual sicko that likes to abuse animals and says, oh, I know this guy, I know this guy, I know this guy. And then you would read online that this guy would be in different states and arrested for this and this and this and this. And it was just, he was a scumbag.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what happens on the Internet, where you get these people, you get these trolls that look to take advantage of people. I mean, you know, Dan Quinn, I interviewed Dan Quinn on the 5th He's in Sacramento County Jail. His trial's not for several weeks. Now, Dan was a very popular internet figure. He still is. Dan was on TMZ.com. He's been on numerous websites. His stevia videos are tremendously popular, and I've kept in contact with Dan, and it's great. I mean, you know, I don't know if Dan is really appreciative of the social network, the websites that have made him famous, but it also brought about creeps, people threatening Dan, people posting real negative stuff about his children, about his mother, about me. You know, I've been involved with this stuff. I've received phone calls. Riley Prystock of 5150 Fightwear has received phone calls, and that's part of the dark side of the internet. But you have to really know how to manage it. You have to know how to weed these people out. And one of the good things about Facebook is Facebook actually has pretty good blocking features, where if you're harassed or you don't want to friend someone, you have a mechanism to sort of defend yourself against some of these creatures out there. But it does exist, and I learned how to deal with them. I mean, I had experience. You know, when I first started my radio show, I had a lot of problems with internet guys that knew what they were doing online and hated my guts, and they made my life a living hell. You know, I had my address posted online. I had my phone number. I had my parents' names. You can just imagine. And eventually, I knew how to deal with it. I learned a lot from you know, having negative online experiences. And I suggest everybody, don't let it get to you. You know, there are people out there now, especially kids that are in high school and middle school now, they're subjected to a tremendous amount of pressure, and something can go online, and you see these teenagers killing themselves because a video was posted or this and that. We live in a very, very cruel society, and internet has made it easier for people to harass other people. But my suggestion is just, you know, play fair. Don't try to troll people online. Don't try to, you know, aggravate people. Do what you got to do, and you know, you'll be fine.
Exactly, because last year we even had a troll that was trying to troll me. Last year, it was like right before I left the show for a little while, and this person was like, you need to come visit this website and blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to waste my time with stupid trolls. So.
Yeah, and that's just what it is. It's just a crawl. Blog talk, sometimes these people come in the chat room, and you just block them. And they say some terrible things. I mean, don't get me wrong. They say some just horrible things. And some of these people, like, and they never post under a real name. They never post under their real identity. It's always some fake name or some troll account. And that just only further identifies them as trolls. And, you know, one thing about Jay Ray and myself is that we don't post on any troll account. We post under our names. We are who we are. We stand behind what we say and what we do. And, you know, so a lot of people, I think, are jealous of that. They don't have the courage to have a radio show each week and get behind a microphone and tell the world how they feel. And so they have to knock what they can't do down. And it's unfortunate. But you know what? I don't spend a lot of time thinking about these clowns. I really don't. I'm just looking ahead, Justin.
Mm-hmm. And like we said, even with radio shows, Bob, there is this one show that I really liked but gets on my nerves because they post a show every day. Now, how are you supposed to promote your popular shows when you're posting something every damn day of the week?
Yeah, that's a little overkill. I mean, I listen to Tom Hartman, who's a brilliant progressive host out of Washington, D.C., and I subscribe to his podcast, and Tom does a show every day. He gets paid for it, though, but he has it available on his website. And, you know, to me, it's overkill. Unless you're getting paid for it, unless it's your full-time job, there's no reason to be doing a show every day. And I know there's this show, and I met the guy that does the show, and I didn't really care for him. He's one of these guys that always talks about himself and just doesn't listen. I just can't stand those types of people. But what? it is what it is. Nobody's forcing us to listen to him. And if he doesn't care about us, if he doesn't want to listen to what people have to say, then fuck him. Get him out.
Exactly, Bob. And the last thing I want to touch on before we go, do you think that paper money will be obsolete and money will be digital like you see in these movies?
It's 10 o'clock.
And stuff instead of having... No?
No, I don't. I think that money is always going to be printed by central banks, and our central bank is the Federal Reserve. I think money needs to be printed because you can't really have a currency that's pegged to gold because there's not enough gold to run the economy. I mean, there was a shortage of gold, and you can always print money. I don't believe that printing money necessarily causes inflation. I think that there's an argument to be made about that. The Zeitgeist films really go in depth about this, but the printing of money is necessary, I think, to fund our economy because you essentially have to create it out of thin air. And this is like a whole other show in itself. But I got to run, Justin. I just want to tell everybody you can visit my Facebook page at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. And, I don't know what you're doing, but I may call you here in a little bit to discuss some things. But
yes, I'll be home in a little while, my friend.
Oh, okay, Bob. And thank you for calling into the show. And it's been a pleasure, and I'll be speaking to you soon, Bob.
Great job tonight, Justin. I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later, Bob.
Goodbye.
Bye. And I hope you have enjoyed tonight's broadcast as much as I would love to stick around. The show must end, so let me see if I can't play you guys a song.
This is Jay Ray, the co-host of Carson's Corner on Underground Progressive Radio. This is Jay Ray, the co-host of Carson's Corner on Underground Progressive Radio.
Hi, this is your host from SYM Radio with a public service announcement. We have an endangered missing senior citizen alert. He is a 78-year-old Cleveland, Ohio man who has been missing since December 7th, 2006. He was 73 at...